Today's Tay Show will be on case 86 in the Heikigan Roku, the P.N. Lu, the Blue Rock Collection, Blue Cliff Record. Case 86 is entitled Umon's Everybody Has His Own Light. Engo's introduction. Controlling the world, he allows not the least speck of dust to escape. He cuts off the diluted stream of thought, leaving not a drop behind. If you open your mouth, you are mistaken. If you doubt for a moment, you have missed the way. Tell me, what is the eye that has pierced barriers? Main subject. Umon spoke to his assembly and said, everybody has his own light. If he tries to see it, everything is darkness. What is everybody's light? Later, in place of the disciples, he said, the hall and the gate. And again he said, blessed things cannot be better than nothing. Secho's verse, it illuminates itself, absolutely bright. It gives a clue to the secret. Flowers have fallen, trees give no shade. Who does not see if he looks? Seeing is non-seeing, non-seeing is seeing. Facing backward on the ox, he rides into the Buddha Hall. So, I want to thank everybody for really deep sitting this morning. People were sitting very still, and of course we had that long sit in the morning, which is a challenge, right? Getting through three sits with a minimal breaks, right? Very challenging, and yet everybody sat so deeply, so well. I want to thank you for that. And I want to thank you for, how shall I put it? Thank you for being so disobedient, so disobedient. You know, last night I came home and I got home around, I left here around 5:45 and I drove home to my house in Plainfield. And I came in and my wife, Barbara, was watching the CNN. And, you know, basically they had newsmen and newswomen all over the country, here in Iowa, here in Florida, here in all the swing states, right? And so, you know, I was just trying to catch a little bite to eat before we started our sit. And she was so distressed. You know, she was saying, oh my God, Trump might just win this, you know? And thank you for not doing that to yourselves. And thank you for being such disobedient people. You know, because you're becoming here in a certain way, you're disobeying all the instructions of the culture in which you were raised, if I may say so, the society in which you were raised, many of them. You know, coming here to sit is not going to be something you can put on a career CV, on your resume, right? You aren't going to be able to make any, I hope, you aren't going to be able to make any money off of meditation, although some people have made a lot of money. You know, people would say, you know, you did what? What? You know, on your weekend, what did you do? I meditated for 8 hours on Saturday, and I got up the next day and I started meditating. We meditated for 7 hours on Sunday. And my legs hurt so much and I was so tired. And people would say, why did you do that? Why did you do that? You know, I every once in a while I'll go to some event where somebody will say, oh, I understand you teach Zen. And I'll say, oh, yes, yeah, I've been doing Zen for about 40 years. And people will say, do you meditate a lot? And I'll say, oh, I probably meditate at least 2 hours every day. And I get up at 5 a.m. to meditate. And then I meditate at night. People are like, they're incredulous. Their jaws drop. You know, if I'd said to people at a party, do you watch television? You know, and they'd say, yeah, I do watch. I said, how much do you watch? They'd have to think about it. Because, you know, the average American, believe it or not, the average American watches 4 hours of television a day. That's a advertiser's statistic. And if I said, my God, you watch 2 hours of television a day, right? They would think, what's wrong with you? Of course, you know, of course. So, you know, basically coming here and doing this is coming from a different place, right? You're not going to make any money. It's not a line on your CV. And in many ways, you're not doing what your culture told you to do. You're not learning anything, for example, right? You're not going to come away with some new knowledge that you could turn into a book deal or an article. If you're an academic, you could turn this into an article. You know, you're going to come away from this with nothing. And that is actually the most wonderful thing in the world. The most wonderful thing in the world. I was just reading something a few days ago by a man, he's a Zen teacher named Jundo Cohen. And he was interviewed about Zen, and the interviewer kept trying to get him to say that this was useful in some way. And Cohen kept saying, no, Zazen is totally useless. This is no, I'm sorry, it's useless. And the guy kept saying, well, but it helps you calm down, doesn't it? And he said, it's useless, you know. What good is calming down? You know, that's useless too. So he was sort of playing a game with the interviewer. But it's so important to remember that the values of our culture are not healthy values, right? They're not. And in fact, you know, actually, some of our most basic assumptions are not real, are not true, you know. One of the things that is not true is, I think, that we're human beings, right? You know, one of the things we learn very early in our life is that we're people and animals are animals, right? And if you study biology, one of the first things you learn is that that's not true, that humans are animals too, right? It's very difficult for people to still avoid thinking of themselves as like not human, right? But actually, the human is an idea or it's an invention, right? And it has a long history, but actually there is no such thing. Yesterday we were talking about there's no such thing as a fish, right? There's no such thing as a fish, this science journalist said. And there's actually no such thing as a human. You know, everything we think about as human is probably a trait we share with many other creatures, right? So for example, I have a cat who is clearly capable of manipulating my emotions, right? I'm sure the cat has what they call mirror neurons, you know, is able to think about what I'm thinking and then sort of beat me to the punch, right? But many animals have, you know, love, are capable of love, anger, calculation, jealousy, you know, all the things that we think of as human traits. You know, so, you know, it takes a lot of courage, right, to not be a human, actually, to just let that go. And, you know, when you come into the Zendo and you sit for a couple of days, you're starting to let that go. You're starting not to be a human being, you know, actually. You know, we're not studying great works of moral philosophy, right? We're not reading the Bible or the Quran or Torah or Talmud or any of those things. We're just sitting down and we're entering emptiness, mu xing. So we sit down on the cushion and we watch the breath, and at the end of the breath, there's a kind of stillness or emptiness. And you want to keep going to that place. And at first, it feels like nothing. It's just like that. You're there and you're gone. You're there and you're gone. But if you continue to return to that place, you realize it's bigger than you thought, right? It's like actually like vast ocean, really. It's like we don't go there very often. But when we practice Zazen, you know, we sit down on the cushion, we go to this place, we follow the breath, and you begin to notice that that emptiness is vast, you know, and the more you go there, the vaster it becomes. And you realize, you know, the sutras often say that humans have upside, that people have upside down views, meaning we see the world in a very, very distorted way, not just Americans, not just modern people, but people in general. And one of the things one of the ways we have upside down views is that we are very interested in thoughts, sensations, ideas, and experiences, but they're very small compared to this vastness that you find at the end of the breath. And, you know, so Zen practice, especially in its initial stages, is just learning not to be distracted by, you know, those thoughts, that craving for different kinds of experiences, memories, and following the breath, which reliably takes you back to that empty space between your thoughts. And the longer you stay there, the deeper your experience of that emptiness becomes, the vaster it becomes. And the more you go to that place, the more you realize, right, that you, one way to put it is that you're not a human. You're not a human. That human, being human, is a kind of game we play. It's a game we play. That you know, at first, this emptiness feels very strange. It can even feel frightening. But eventually, you know, it's like something switches in yourself and you realize that, you know, the part of yourself that thinks and craves and worries and is jealous and fearful is just part of who you are. But there's this other part of who you are, which is this vastness. You know, we recite in the afternoon sutras, this vastness that underlies us all. This vastness is something totally different from that small self. And, you know, when we go into that vastness, you know, we begin to realize that that other stuff is less consequential than we thought. It's less, you know, less consequential. It seems so real, right, when you're in it, that, you know, you know, it's like when you go, you know, if you're working very hard in your job, maybe too hard, and you're putting in too many hours, right? You know, little things start to count way more than they should, right? So, you know, if you go to a meeting and somebody isn't listening to you and you're trying to make a point, you know, you could come back to your office and just be furious, you know. Okay, so then you go on vacation and let's say you go to, you go to Belize or someplace like that, you know, and you're out in the jungle, you're looking at parrots, you're meeting with Mayan people in their beautiful clothes. You know, suddenly the conversation doesn't matter so much, right? You know, it doesn't matter so much. You know, we have, we get too caught up in that world, too caught up in that fictional character you call Kurt, or you call Susan, or you call Bob, right? Those are fictional characters that we've invented and that we're playing out that role, right? And we invent a fictional character actually so we can feel like we have more control than we do, you know? So, you know, actually events are sort of moving, according to Buddhist teaching, events move in accord with what we call causes and effects, or causes and conditions. So things are just happening. These complex systems are unfolding, and we're created by these complex systems, and we're sort of, you could say, like an emergent property of these complex systems. And, you know, it's difficult to deal with that because it makes you realize just how contingent your existence is. You know, and actually from moment to moment, we're changing very much, you know, very much. And so, you know, we create this fiction of a person who's in control, right? Kurt, I'm the master of my fate. I'm in control of my life. And this is comforting, right? Because it makes it seem as though I'm in charge of all the things that are happening to me, instead of these things unfolding in a complex system over which I have very minimal control. So, you know, I myself grew up in a middle-class family. And one of the things my father always used to tell me was how important education was. So it's not a surprise that I went to graduate school, you know, and got an education. But, you know, I could imagine that all of this is my doing, right? I did all of this. These were all my choices. Right? So, you know, basically we've invented a character, what we call Kurt, or we call Susan, or we call Bob, to conceal from ourselves how much of our life is out of our control, is just unfolding according to causes and conditions. And that's one of the most basic teachings that the Buddha ever taught, that everything happens according to causes and conditions and that the self is an illusion. That's what the Buddha said. So you know, we cling to this idea that there's a self so it can remind us or can convince us that we're in charge. But, you know, we're not in charge, and that causes us a lot of anguish and upset. So, for example, you aren't going to be able to determine who becomes president. I went to vote. I took my ballot to a Union County balloting center and signed it with in front of a witness and so on. But, you know, we can't determine the outcome. And, you know, people work very hard to conceal from themselves that these are causes and conditions that we can't control, right? We aren't going to be able to control them. You know, and that causes us a lot of anguish. It'll especially cause us a lot of anguish on the 5th if Joe Biden doesn't win. But it's so important to realize that Kurt is a fictional character and that all of these things are happening based on causes and conditions that are mostly outside of our control. And that, you know, we can get trapped in this perspective because, you know, much of our behavior is designed to protect the fiction of myself, the fiction of my control over things. You know, so Culture wants us, our culture, our society wants us to believe in the reality of all this. But, you know, some people begin to see through it. It begins to become unconvincing. And then they stumble into something like Zen, right? And you sit down on the cushion, and for a long time, you're just practicing Zen to be more efficient at your job or to get rid of stress. So you have an anxiety problem. That's how I got started with Zen. But, you know, one day you stumble into this emptiness and you realize that, you know, I'm not really Kurt. That's just a game I play. I'm not really Kurt, you know, or I don't have to be Kurt. You know, I don't have to be Kurt. There's this other mode of life that I can participate in, you know, where I'm not going to worry about the unfolding of causes and conditions. I'm not going to follow the instructions that I've been given. I'm going to live from a different place, right? Different place. You know, and when you go into that emptiness, you know, it begins to transform you. On day one of our little sesshin, I talked about purifying body, heart, and mind. You know, we're stepping out of all those, you could say, illusions, or all of those pretend, you know, the games of let's pretend that we play in order to be members of the human community that we were raised in. And, you know, we enter this emptiness and we suddenly realize that that's all a game. That's all a game. And now it's possible to interact with everything in a very different way. It's like, instead of fighting it all the time, becoming one with, the process. Becoming one with the unfolding of things. And it takes a lot of time to get to that place. But when you get to that place, it's really glorious. I mean, if you haven't done much sitting, maybe you've had a little taste of that. You know, like on a Wednesday night, you do three sits and it's hard. Your legs hurt. Your back hurts. You know, but, you know, at the end of the evening, you walk outside and you just feel different. It's like a weight is lifted off your shoulders, or like you're interacting with the world in a very different way. It's like there's no longer all of these curtains or screens between you and the world. Now you're experiencing the world without trying to protect yourself, right? Or preserve yourself. And when you do that, you realize that there is no boundary between yourself and what's happening. We're like a little acorn on a tree, you know, and we're hanging up on the tree and we're looking down and we're saying, oh my God, you know, I'm 40 feet up, you know, and then, you know, one day we fall into the ground, right? And it's like, oh my God, I've fallen down, right? And then, you know, you're lying there in the ground and you're thinking, what's going to happen to me? You know, what's going to happen to me? Oh no, I'm sinking into the ground. I'm splitting open. Oh no, you know. And then you're an oak tree, right? So, you know, we don't know we're an oak tree, right? We don't see the whole trajectory. But there's this whole process unfolding that has produced us and is transforming us, right? And we don't trust it because we can't control it. But, you know, in the sutra we cite in the morning, we say, this is one with the trusting mind. You know, one with the trusting mind. What does that mean? You know, how can you have a trusting mind when Trump might get reelected as president? You know, you've got to fight. But, you know, if you can step out of the mind, that we say small mind, that's trying to fight, and you become one with these, with what the poet, you know, there's a wonderful line in Howl, if you know Allen Ginsberg's poetry. So he calls the universe the starry dynamo. Becoming one with the starry dynamo is the way of the ancestors, you know. And you become one with the starry dynamo when you come to Sesshin and you sit for 8 or 9 hours a day and your legs hurt. And little by little, you spend more and more time in that place, that little space between your breath, and you gradually transform yourself from, you know, somebody who's, you know, a good person, I assume. You know, most people who do this start out as good people, as a matter of fact. You know, we don't get too many gangsters in Zen, you know. You know, you transform yourself into something that's really not human. Buddhas are really not human. In fact, you know, the basic teaching of Buddhism is that your destiny isn't to be a human. Isn't that interesting? That's absolutely so. The Buddha said, you know, basically to be a human is to be subject to the three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion. That's the human state. So, you know, the Buddha said, don't be a human, please. You know, be something else. Be something that has no name. So this koan is an interesting, is a really coming at this all in a certain way. Uman spoke to the assembly. Let me back up. Engo's introduction. Remember that Zen koans are loaded with false cues and misinformation. Engo's introduction starts out like this: controlling the world, he allows not the least speck of dust to escape. See? Now, what Engo is doing is setting you up to misunderstand everything, right? He's blowing smoke, as we say. You think, yes, you know, the woman of Zen, the man of Zen will control the world and allow not a single speck of dust to escape. He cuts off the diluted stream of thought, leaving not a drop behind. You know, you might think, that's what I have to do. That's what I have to do. I have to be in control. I have to be, as we used to say, tight-assed about my practice, right? I have to watch everything carefully. But actually, you know, Zen is really about going to that place, that emptiness, and letting everything go. You know, if you would like my advice, I think Zen is about please stop fighting. Yeah, please stop fighting. Stop fighting. You know, go to the place where that emptiness begins to open up and become one with everything. That's the path. So Uman says to his assembly, Uman's name means cloud gate, Yun Men. He said, everybody has his own light. And we think, oh, great, everybody has his own light. But then notice what he says. He says, if you try to see it, everything is darkness. So you can't try. You have, you know, Zen is about trying, but then letting go. Right? Trying, but then letting go. So if you try to see your own light, you'll never see it. You know, that's what Uman says. You know, there are certainly people who meditate in the wrong, I would say, in a misleading way, right? You can read books and they'll say, visualize the light. Now become one with the light, right? That is deeply bad advice. Right? Because all you're doing is creating a mental image of light, and it's conforming to all your assumptions and beliefs. And so it doesn't belong to that vastness. It belongs to that part of yourself, which is trying to win, always fighting, trying to be a self, trying to be a person. You know, the way we get to the light in ourselves is to sit until we're tired and And then, you know, basically it's hard to give up. It's hard to give up. You know, there's a part of us that, damn it, just doesn't want to lose, just doesn't want to not be a self, right? But, you know, if you let yourself go through this process enough times, you know, this day two, we're right at day two of Sesshin. Day two is where it usually gets tough for people. You know, ideally, the Sesshin is 5 to 7 days. And what happens to people is on day one, they come to Sesshin, they have high expectations, and people even might be thinking, you know, I might have an enlightenment experience, so-called. And then, on day two, people begin, you know, you get up the next day. We had a little extra sleep, which was good and bad. We had a little extra sleep. But, you know, usually you don't get the extra sleep, so you're a little more tired than we are today. And, you know, we did that long sit and then another hour sit with no break. And, you know, you're by late afternoon, by afternoon sutras, you know, you're tired, your legs hurt. And you reach a point where you just can't fight anymore, right? You just can't fight. You can't struggle to be special anymore. You can't struggle to win, right? And, you know, at some point you just let it go. You just let it all go. And that's where usually around day three, people undergo a profound change. You know, it's like, okay, I'm not going to be a self. I'm not going to have anything to add to my resume. I haven't written any articles. I haven't, you know, when I die, nobody's even going to remember my name, you know, as a matter of fact. Isn't that wonderful? You know, now I'm not telling you should quit your job and take your name off your mailbox and so on. But you know, there's a way of living your life which is a lot more lighthearted and open-hearted. And it comes from not playing the game of being a self or having a self. You know, if you allow yourself to give up that project, to give up the project of having a self or being a self, to lose at that game, you know, everything becomes a wonderful experience. You know, everything becomes a wonderful experience. Gain and loss, we say in the morning, gain and loss, right and wrong, such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. So, you know, this is day two of Sesshin, and we're going to finish here this morning and have lunch and come back and do a lot more sitting. And, you know, we'll get tired as the day goes on, but, you know, you're getting closer and closer to that moment where you're going to give up the project of being a human being, of being a person, of having a name and a birthday and so on, which you'll still have. But you can occupy those in a very different way. You know, you and I are just the universe pretending to be Kurt and the universe pretending to be Sandy and so on. You know, but you can't be the universe pretending to be Kurt by thinking I'm the universe pretending to be Kurt. You know, you sort of have to wear yourself out. You have to, you know, basically it's hard to break free from our habitual clinging to the dream of being a self, right? It's hard, right? And in fact, the more threatened we feel, the more desperately we cling to it. But, you know, if we just keep sitting today, you know, you're going to begin to breathe the free air of having no self. You know, there's a, I wanted to read one more koan because it's a different way of coming at all this. This is like two koans for the price of one today. But Linji, the Zen master Linji, ran into a temple superintendent And Lin Ji asked the temple superintendent, "Where are you coming from?" And the superintendent said, "From selling rice in the city. This is my job. This is my business." Lin Ji said, "Did you sell it all?" And the superintendent said, "I sold it all." So this is a Zen question. Did you really sell it all? And Lin Ji drew a stroke with his staff on the ground, and he said, "Did you sell this one?" The superintendent immediately shouted. So basically Lin Ji said, "Okay, you're doing your work. You're living in the world. But are you free, or are you still caught in this game we call being a self or having a self?" And so he said, "You sold all the rest, but did you sell it? Did you sell everything? Did you sell everything?" And the superintendent is a deeply awakened person, and he says, "Listen, I let all of that go long ago. I let that all go long ago. I wore myself out, right? And now I'm here pretending to be the superintendent of the temple, just like you're pretending to be Lin Ji." And that to live that way is to be a bodhisattva, a bosatsu, right? To be a bodhisattva is to be here, but not here, right? To be living this life from that vastness that underlies us all. And the root to that vastness is the root pretty much the route we're taking. You know, you have to wear out the self on the cushion. You go back again and again and again. Around day two, you get your legs get tired, your back gets tired. But, you know, if you keep going back to that place, you know, one day, day three of Sesshin, you will become different kind of human being. And then you go home from Sesshin and forget about it and come to another Sesshin and become a different kind of human being, and so on and so on. But one day, you know, you'll come home and you won't be that person anymore. You'll be a dragon. You'll be the universe living your life. Engo's introduction: controlling the world, he allows not the least speck of dust to escape. He cuts off the diluted stream of thought, leaving not a drop behind. In other words, ignore that advice. If you open your mouth, you are mistaken. If you doubt for a moment, you have missed the way. Tell me, what is the eye that has pierced the barriers? See the following main subject. Cloud Gate spoke to the assembly and he said, "Everybody has his own light, but if he tries to see it, everything is darkness. What is everybody's light?" Nobody could answer. None of his students could answer. Later, in the place of his students, he said, "Let me give you the answer. The answer is the halls and the gate." The halls and the gate. And again, he said, "Blessed things cannot be better than nothing." So what he's really saying is the way to your liberation is through that emptiness. The way to connect with the world, to be the one with the universe, is not to imagine yourself as one with the universe. That's just another idea. But go through that emptiness, and on the other side of the emptiness, everything is waiting for you. Secho's verse, it illuminates itself, absolutely bright. He gives a clue to the secret. Flowers have fallen, trees give no shade. Who does not see if he looks? Seeing is non-seeing, non-seeing is seeing. Facing backward on the ox, he rides into the Buddha hall. See, that's how you get to paradise. Not forward looking for it, but backward. You're on the water buffalo, you're on the animal, and you're looking back. So you're moving backward into paradise, so to speak. You're moving backward into enlightenment. And you move backward into enlightenment by letting everything go and going into emptiness. So everybody's doing a wonderful job. Please continue to be disobedient citizens of our planet and cultivate Mu Xin.